From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this week's podcast, Boston has a bold plan to lure the smartest, most talented women to work in the city by paying them as much as men.
As a young woman, it makes me want to stay here and work here, you know, because I want to live in a city that values me as much as it values its men.
Then the push to let children work in dangerous mines in Bolivia comes from an unexpected lobby.
Chief proponents of lowering the working age to 6 years old are child workers themselves.
And on the reality show Bar Rescue, John Taffer turns around struggling drinking holes. Now he brings his magic to our studio.
I think you do much better radio after a few glasses of bourbon, wouldn't you think?
Don't worry, we'll pace ourselves. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. First, a more serious story. It sounds unthinkable, but there are times, according to the rules of war, when it is acceptable to shoot a child. A 12-year-old can, of course, fire a rifle, but the more gut-wrenching decisions revolve around ambiguous situations. Could a child with a cell phone be a lookout for insurgents or sending a detonation signal to an IED? These were the types of awful scenarios the soldiers had to face in Iraq and Afghanistan. Carl Prine is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review and served in Iraq himself. A few years ago, he began hearing stories from members of Charlie Troop, part of the 82nd Airborne, one of the most decorated units in Army history. The story centered on an incident involving the killing of three Iraqi teenagers.
Every man I talked to had the Purple Heart. These are not the kind of guys who are wishy-washy soldiers by any stretch of the imagination, and yet they were all scarred by this one event that happened, and they never quite recovered from it.
That's Carl Prine. He wrote about the incident in a series of award-winning articles in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. The story begins in March of 2007. A small team led by then-Staff Sergeant Michael Barbera were on a reconnaissance mission outside of the village of Asada in rural Iraq. The night before, these soldiers set themselves up in a palm grove overlooking what they believed to be an insurgent safe house.
By morning, they had moved slightly. They were in a dip in the land. And while they were in there, two kids started driving some cattle toward them. The cattle got so close they could actually feel the breath of the cows on their faces. Several of the men had a shot on the boys. Had they shown what they call intent to harm, they would have dropped them. If they had carried weapons, if they were moving toward them in an aggressive manner, they would have shot them on the spot. So as these boys kept coming, the men took their fingers slowly off the triggers. The idea as scouts, as cavalry scouts, was to let them pass. If they don't see them, then let them go. One man stood up, that was allegedly then Staff Sergeant Barbera, stood up, shot the first boy. He goes down. Second boy turned, began to scream, and he shot him too. Then they fled across the palm grove. They didn't know at the time. I found out later. The boys were both deaf and dumb. They could not speak and they couldn't hear. So they never heard the shots that killed them.
So what happened from that point leading to the encounter with the third boy?
Bedlam. According to the soldiers, Barbera was panicked. He ran from one side of the palm grove deep into a more forested part of the palm grove. While they were back there, another young man was walking toward them, just emerged out of the shadows. He seemed oblivious to them. He didn't hear them. He was moving in the same direction as the gunshots, which was inexplicable. Now, they saw that he had a satchel. He seemed to be reaching for a black metal object. Barbera ordered them to fire. The men fired. The Army later ruled that that was a good kill, that even though the boy was innocent, he actually was a cousin of these two young men who were dying in the field behind him, and also deaf. He was actually going out to bring them to lunch.
And we should point out that this might sound outrageous to people, but the insurgents in Iraq did use children as lookouts and in other capacities.
Yeah. These kids would not have been used, however. A child who couldn't communicate with the insurgents would have been worthless.
Do you think it's at all possible, though, given the confusion of war and that children would be used, that there was any way that Staff Sergeant Barbera might have been confused about those first two?
Well, that becomes the question. Certainly, there didn't seem to be any confusion with the witnesses who turned him in. Whether he had some confusion or not, it remains in question.
The incident haunted the men of Barbera's troop, but no action was taken against Barbera himself. Carl Prine actually went to Iraq to meet the families of the slain boys. he was shocked to discover he was not the first American to come asking questions. The villagers told him that American Army investigators had also looked into the story, supposedly even reporting it to senior officials. According to Carl Prine, the commanding generals have total discretion over whether or not to prosecute, and in the case of the Iraqi boys who were killed, those generals did nothing.
The Army, these generals determined that he had committed murder. But instead of sending him to a court-martial, they decided they would give him what's called the General Officer Memorandum of Reprimand. It's below the stage of nonjudicial punishment, slightly above perhaps a counseling statement, and that this one was going to be local, that it was never going to go into his permanent file. He signed it, admitting that he had shot these two children and he had violated the rules of engagement, but he was never charged with murder.
Not only that, Barbera was promoted to Sergeant First Class and assigned his own platoon. The report of his actions in Iraq all but disappeared, and as for making reparations toward the families of the dead boys...
They had paid the family some money for about $2,000 for each boy who was killed. They had apologized, sort of, and they had asked a lot of questions about what happened.
Only last month, the military began the process that could lead to charges against Barbera. Carl Prine has no idea why it took the military so long to act, although he's heard lots of theories.
A lot of soldiers are quick to throw out theories about it. They've suggested that it's because a lot of careers of senior officers were involved in that unit, and this was going to get into the way. Others have suggested that there was a lot of unit pride, and the last thing that the generals wanted was to have a story, so they quieted that. And a lot of other people said, well, you know, they didn't really have any physical evidence. I think more likely what happened was the American military's judiciary was not at the same place it was then that it is now. Today, a lot of these cases coming out of Afghanistan, they devote a lot of resources to it. In 2007 through 2010, with two wars going on, not as many resources to go around.
Carl, do you have a sense that there might be, how many other stories there might be out there like this that we just have not encountered?
Oh, yes. Hundreds. I've talked about this privately with CID agents, and they've told me they believe there are hundreds of these cases.
That's Carl Prine. He's a reporter with the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. His series on the death of three Iraqi teens in 2007 is called Rules of Engagement. It doesn't matter if you're a surgeon, a banker, or if you catch fish for a living. If you're a woman in this country, you tend to get paid less for the same work than a man. The feminist movement and decades of new laws have not changed that stubborn fact. Now Boston thinks it has a solution. The city is working to become the first in the country to completely erase the gender wage gap. But will it work? That's our cover story today. First, from member station WBUR, Asma Khalid reports.
On average, women across the country are paid 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. In Boston, that discrepancy is not as extreme. A typical woman makes 85 cents for every buck a man makes. Some say that number needs to be adjusted for factors like career choice and motherhood, and then it'll rise to 91 cents. But even then, for Boston's Mayor Tom Menino, 9 cents is still 9 cents too little.
Women work as hard, they're smart. Just because we're a woman, they get discriminated against. We're going to end that discrimination in Boston. That's what pay equity is all about.
Menino is a straight-talking, no-nonsense kind of man. He's on his way out, but he's been mayor here for 20 years. So when he says things need to change, people listen. Boston Simmons College touts itself as the school with the top MBA program for women. But even the type of students who attend this school say they felt the stings of unequal pay in the past.
I have actually experienced a situation where my compensation wasn't comparable to a male counterpart.
That's Estelle Archibald.
Oh, it was at least $20,000 worth of a gap, which is a significant quality of life issue.
Archibald was working for a consulting company. She says she asked for more money and got it, but it wasn't easy. Women like Archibald are a driving force in Boston's economy. Bostonians proudly say their city is uniquely capable of eliminating the gender wage gap because of sheer demographics. The city is home to the highest proportion of young, educated women in the country.
So when we started to think about closing the wage gap, we thought about it from the beginning as a business initiative.
That's Kathy Minahan. She's the dean of Simmons Business School and the woman leading the city's initiative. Minahan heads a citywide council that has persuaded more than 40 businesses to sign a pledge to close the wage gap. Some are small, but others are powerhouses in the region, such as Partners Healthcare, the biggest private employer in the city. Companies that sign the compact agree to take three concrete steps. Minahan says the most crucial step is the first one, for companies to open their books and assess their own wage data.
Sometimes people reject the idea that we have an issue until they actually see their data. And then they say to themselves, huh.
Then they'll pick three strategies to improve pay equity. There's a whole laundry list of suggestions recommended by the council, and companies choose what they like. The ideas include things like increasing wage transparency, actively recruiting women to executive-level positions, and offering subsidized childcare. And then finally, businesses agree to share their wage data anonymously every 2 years so that the city can measure progress. The catch is that none of this is actually required. It's all voluntary. Kathy Minahan claims that's its strength.
We wanted this to be something that businesses felt strongly was in their best interest.
But will this approach be enough to disrupt the old boys' club? Katie Donovan started a company called Equal Pay Negotiations. She says there are systemic hiring practices that discriminate against women.
We have to get rid of salary history. It's on every application. All it does is set us up for failure, because if you're a woman, you're going to have a lower salary history than, excuse me, but the white men. They get the premium.
A lot of women also say they need to learn to advocate for themselves. The onus to fix this problem can't rest solely with the employer. But whether or not the idea gains traction, just the fact that Boston has made pay equity a priority is enough of a selling point for grad student Megan Williams.
I want to live in a city that values me as much as it values its men.
The city is hoping a lot of Boston businesses feel the same way. By the end of the year, it expects to have 50 companies on board. For NPR News, I'm Asma Khalid.
There are a lot of city and state governments that are trying to take on pay disparities at the local level, like Boston. But despite these new laws, Heather Boucher from the Center for American Progress says the pay gap persists.
Interestingly, we find that that is about the same across the educational distribution. So even if you get a college degree, you earn more than a guy with some college or a high school degree, but you don't actually, on average, earn more than a man with a college degree. One thing we know is that there's a big gap between women who are mothers and women who aren't. And that gap actually can't be accounted for simply by the presence of children. So if a woman who doesn't have kids takes off 6 months for touring Europe, and then a woman who does have children takes off 6 months to care for her new baby, you see that it's not that time that's causing that pay gap. It's actually the presence of having a child that is causing that gap. And we don't do a lot in this country to really help equalize that.
There's still, though, a lot of opposition to laws like this. For instance, you know, the Fair Pay Act, every year for almost two decades now, Congress has opted to not pass that. Could you explain what that law is and why it faced this kind of opposition?
The Fair Pay Act is a piece of legislation that has been introduced by Senator Harkin. It would actually require that firms do more to ensure that workers that are doing the same kinds of jobs are actually being paid similarly. One of the insidious ways that you see the pay gap playing out in our economy is that you have workers that have similar kinds of skills that are required for their job, and they're doing similar kinds of tasks. But because we call them by different names, and one is a job that tends to be held by women, and one is a job that tends to be held by men, and lo and behold, the job that tends to be held by men is paid more than the other, that is what this Fair Pay Act seeks to do.
What about people who would say that, look, the reason this is so intractable is because it's culture. You know, culture is the reason, and you can't change culture with laws.
Well, we have changed a lot of cultures with laws, and they certainly they go hand in hand. The example that I think for me immediately comes to mind are laws around same-sex marriage, where the changes in our culture and how we feel about that as a society has gone hand in hand with legislative changes. The first piece of legislation that President Obama signed into law in his first term of office was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Now, that was an important piece of legislation, but it didn't actually push the ball forward. What it did was undid a Supreme Court decision that said that Lilly Ledbetter could not get damages due to discrimination because the discrimination had happened almost 20 years before. But what I think was interesting about that moment is how much attention the president got for signing that legislation and how important it seems to be to women around the country. And I think closing the loop in terms of the kinds of policies that can really push the ball forward and make sure that women are earning a fair day's pay, there's an opportunity right now for that that I think then could affect the culture as well.
Heather Boucher is the chief economist for the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Heather, thank you.
Thank you.
Remember those Chilean miners who spent more than 2 months trapped underground? What if I told you they were the lucky ones? Many miners in South America work in conditions far more dangerous, and some of them are as young as 6 years old. Their daily travails would shock Charles Dickens, but now some children in Bolivia are unionizing and asking the government to lower the working age. Wes and Zena went into the mines in the city of Potosí to understand why, and he writes about the experience for Vice magazine.
The Spanish began mining in Potosí in 1554. There had been indigenous groups living there prior to that, but when the Spanish arrived, they found this enormous mountain, the Cerro Rico, the Rich Hill, and it was chock full of silver deposits. So they employed the indigenous Quechua Indians who were living there to extract all the silver.
This mountain has been mined for 500 years. It's almost hard to imagine. So what is it like at this point after 500 years of mining?
So today, the Cerro Rico, the mine, is nearly exhausted. In fact, it's been mined so extensively that some people fear that it could collapse at any moment. Parts of it have collapsed because it's basically been carved out from the inside.
And in this very dangerous place, you went in search of these child miners and you found them. You see the pictures of them in your article. How many of these kid miners are out there and what are their lives like?
There are 3,000 of these miners ranging in age from 6 to 16. In 2008, 60 of them died from cave-ins, from accidents inside the mines. We primarily spent time with one young miner who was 15 years old. And he had been working in the mines since he was 12 years old. And Jose Luis, this was the young miner's name, he supplements his family's income. He has a large family. His father works in the mines and doesn't make enough to quite support the family. They scrounge for silver, for tiny, tiny bits of silver, for lead and zinc, and then they sell it to a smelter. They basically work as freelancers for a very little amount of money. And so Jose Luis is the oldest son. So he some days makes $40, U.S. dollars, which is a lot in Bolivia. Some days he doesn't make anything. And half of that money goes toward the family. Half of the money goes toward his own school supplies.
You know, one of the most striking things in your piece, it's legal for children under the age of 14 to work in Bolivia. But you wrote about how when people want to raise the working age, there are kids that are protesting that, and kids that actually want to lower the working age.
Right. In the Western world, in the U.S. and Europe and Japan, child labor has mostly been eradicated. It's less than 1% of the total workforce. In Latin America and in Africa and Asia, it's still a huge problem. Bolivia is a small country. The population of the entire country is 10.5 million. There are 848,000 workers under the age of 18, and nearly 500,000 of them are between the ages of 6 and 14. So 1 in 3 children work. And so one of the proposed solutions to the persistence of child labor in the 21st century has been to try to legalize child labor. That's what's being proposed in Bolivia. Right now, they're considering legislation to lower the working age to 6 years old. It's the same logic as with any other illicit economy, whether it's prostitution, the sale of drugs, which, you know, there's a moral queasiness provoked by child labor. But the logic of lowering the working age is that if we can't make it go away, we may as well legalize it so that it can be regulated, so that young workers can be protected in the same way adults are. And I mean, the interesting thing in Bolivia, why I decided to visit, is that the chief proponents of lowering the working age to 6 years old there are child workers themselves. There's this union of child workers called UNATSPO, the Union of Child and Adolescent Workers. And it's composed of 6 to 8 year olds who are all working children. They organize protests. They attempt to raise wages. They elect their own leaders. And they've drafted this set of policy recommendations, 200 pages long, about what they think the government should do to regulate child labor.
Wes, one last question I got to ask you is that you're going into this mountain that's just honeycombed with mines. They routinely collapse all the time. People die all the time inside them. There's no map. Were you just freaking out?
Whenever I got scared, I thought of the fact that there are 8-year-olds going into this mine every single day. So at the very least, I can spend a couple hours in there.
Wes Enzena is senior editor for Vice Media. Wes, thank you.
Thanks, Arun.
If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Now for an abrupt change of gear. Meet John Taffer. He's the king of the bar business. He's managed dozens of bars and nightclubs, and he's a no-nonsense consultant for bar owners all over the country. Since 2011, he's hosted the popular reality show, Bar Rescue.
Running a bar is not just a business. It's a science. No one knows more about bar science than John Taffer.
I don't embrace excuses. I embrace solutions.
John Taffer's new book is called Raise the Bar. He and I shared a drink recently here at NPR West. It seemed to me that running a bar was a pretty straightforward business. I couldn't understand why so many need rescuing.
You know, it's a tough business. People think it's inherently profitable, but it's not. You know, the alcohol in a drink is only about 20% of the price. So for every dollar that a drink costs, the cost to the bar is only 20 cents. But that doesn't include labor, insurance, rent. When you're finished, bars are not inherently profitable. You got to work at them to make them profitable.
Talk. I want to hear about your career before you were doing this show.
You know, I went to college for political science.
Okay.
These days, I'm glad I didn't go into that business. But I started tending bar in college, and I fell in love with it.
Well, there's politics to it. I mean, I see that in your program.
No
question. The poli-sci degree probably comes in handy.
It sure does. You know, and understanding contingency plans, and there's a lot of elements of political science that work in bars.
Well, there's this great contrast because, you know, outside with the customers, there's this, the smoothness, the beauty, the experience. Then in the back, you're like a drill sergeant.
It's almost like show business. You know, on stage, off stage. When you're on stage, you're expected to perform in the bar business. You shake your hands, you smile. You're all positive energy. You add to your environment. When you walk in the door to the back of the house, that's like a stage door.
Disgusting.
You're off stage now.
You know, guys, I'm trying to stay calm here, but when I see this, Todd, cockroaches in your flour. If there's roaches in here, there's roaches in a whole kitchen. It could be anywhere.
Now you're a businessman. You're not in the hospitality business, and you're focused on costs, you know, managing your employees and all the other aspects of business. It's a dual existence, really.
So the bars that you've run, what was your favorite?
In the mid-'80s, I opened a bar outside of Pennsylvania called Pulsations. And Pulsations was 56,000 square feet and had a 4-ton spaceship that flew into the nightclub and deposited a $400,000 robot on the dance floor. And that robot was leased for the movie Rocky IV.
I remember that.
And was in that movie. But when that spaceship came out and that robot came down, customers would cry. It was really exciting. And you know, I've strived for that ever since. When it works, boy, it's an exciting thing.
Well, let's talk drinking.
Okay.
We have, I was telling you before, I'm a Scotch whiskey guy.
And we, as actually, am I.
We have some bourbon, though, here with us. So we have a nice bottle. What would you... Presentation is important.
It is presentation. You know, that's a nice bottle of Bullet Bourbon. It's a small batch product. And if you look at the label, it looks like a small batch product, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Small label on a bottom, doesn't have a mass-produced look to it. Suddenly, you have a higher expectation of a product like that. That's good packaging.
So how do we do this justice in a bar?
Well, you know, you got to remember what bars are. The second public building ever built in America was a bar. The first was a church. The first distiller in America was George Washington, made about 10,000 gallons of bourbon a year. So bars are part of the fiber of America. And when they work, they make people feel good. People connect to a great bar, very personally.
You're making me want to drink.
That's a good thing.
Should we open this up?
I think we should.
All right.
A little bullet bourbon shouldn't wait. Now, as a Scotch man, take a little smell of that. Tell me what you think.
Let's see. It's nice. Not quite what I'm used to, but that's, Here, we're christening NPR West.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I think you do much better radio after a few glasses of bourbon, wouldn't you think?
That's nice.
That's smooth?
That's quite nice, yeah. I want to ask you, I know that you break things down visually. You do sort of like a schematic of the bar, like how things are laid out. Taking a look at our studio here, we'd like to make people feel comfortable, like they can talk, like you'd like to have in a good bar. Do you have any recommendations for how we might...
Well, this is actually a really nice, comfortable environment. This is a great space. When you walk in, it's got a hipness to it. It's got an openness to it. So I walk in, I think, okay, this is a pretty cool place. I'm expecting a cool host to talk to. I come into a studio. It's really nice, brightly lit. It's contemporary, has nice angles and lighting in it. You're casually dressed. You're not stuffy. You're smiling and looking at me. It's a nice place to talk on radio, actually.
All right.
So the reactions are good.
Well, John, this has been great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
John Taffer. He's the force behind the reality TV show Bar Rescue. His new book is called Raise the Bar. A couple of weeks ago, a triptych by the painter Francis Bacon, Three Studies of Lucian Freud, sold at auction for over $140 million, the biggest price tag ever for a work of art. It's an amazing piece, Bacon at his brilliant and unnerving best. But it's a peculiar contrast to another auction this week involving some priceless natural history. An exceptionally rare fossil was up for sale. It's known as the Dueling Dinosaurs, two complete specimens dramatically locked in what seems to be a death grip. The auction attracted paleontologists from all over, eager just to get a glimpse of the bones. They were projected to reach $7 to $9 million, just a fraction of a great painting. But they failed to sell at all. Brian Switek is an author and columnist for National Geographic. He joins me now to explain what happened with these bones. Hi, Brian.
Hi, glad to be here.
So first, can you describe the Dueling Dinosaurs, where they were found and why they're so pricey?
Sure, yeah. They were found in 2006 in what's called the Hell Creek Formation in Montana, and they're about 66 million years old. And it seems to be a tyrannosaur and a horned dinosaur called the Ceratops that sort of locked together. Whether they actually were fighting at the time that they died is sort of up in the air. The hype behind this is that these might be new species. They might have been fighting each other when they died. So it's sort of this multiple layers of new dinosaur discoveries.
So can you help us understand the market here? This was a private auction, and it feels a little bit like an art auction. There's a combination, I guess, of rich collectors and investors who are bidding on rare items. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it was a public auction. So the fossil had actually been brought to various museums ahead of time to see if any museums might be interested. But the price tag was astronomical. I mean, the Smithsonian said that they had been approached for about $15 million for this fossil, so even higher than projected sale at auction. And that'd be insane for a museum to actually pay that amount. And that could fund field operations and staff and museum curation for decades, if not centuries. So failing to find a museum home, this went up for a public auction, and anybody could bid on this fossil if they had the money to back it up. I mean, in the past, some people like Nicolas Cage and Leonardo DiCaprio made headlines by getting into bidding wars over dinosaur fossils.
And how do you appraise a fossil like that? I mean, obviously there's a scientific value, but it seems from these dueling dinosaurs that something of it, there's also a factor of their beauty or how cool they look.
Yeah, there are no professional dinosaur appraisers, partially because professional paleontologists, get ulcers seeing these things go up to auction like this. So instead, it often has to do with really what people are willing to pay, and it has to do with the completeness of the specimen, the rarity of the animal, and also the celebrity of the animal. So a complete Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton can go for millions and millions of dollars, whereas for a complete Triceratops or something that's a lot more common or doesn't have the same sort of cultural celebrity attached to it will go for a lot less.
And Brian, obviously people like you are concerned about what is lost to science. Can you talk about, in the case of this fossil in particular, the dueling dinosaurs, if this ends up in a private collection, far from any real scientist's eyes, what do we lose?
Well, every fossil, whether it's a scrap of bone or a tooth or a full skeleton, it's like a time capsule. It contains a lot of secrets about prehistoric life that are being drawn out with more and more different techniques between CT scan and geochemical sampling. And this is also our story. I mean, our ancestors are little snuffly mammals that were living in the shadow of dinosaurs are around at the same time. So if we can understand these dinosaurs better, we can understand the world that they lived in and also where we came from.
So now that it didn't sell, is it likely that this is going to end up in a museum instead of in Nicolas Cage's foyer?
I surely hope so, but you never really know. I mean, the people behind this, you have the private landowners who obviously want to make a good deal of money on this. You have the dinosaur hunter who found it, and lots of sort of fingers in the pot hoping they get a good price for this, which is really going to prohibit a lot of museums from actually being able to afford it. It's almost kind of gone beyond the reach of what paleontologists can afford now. So I'm not really sure what's going on. I heard a few things about deals trying to be worked out with a few museums, but it could wind up almost anywhere. It's really uncertain what's going to happen to this fossil now.
Brian Switek is an author and columnist for National Geographic. Brian, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. You might be too embarrassed to admit it, but I bet at one time or another, you've spent more than a few minutes watching courtroom TV.
Does it sound as if you have to respond to me?
No, but I chose to respond.
Like, does it sound like you have to respond to me?
No, but I chose to.
Well, you can't, because I make the rules.
That's the one and only Judge Judy. But daytime TV is lousy with judges. There's Judge Joe Brown, Judge Mathis. But I'm here to tell you there's a better way. On the internet. There you can find Judge John Hodgman. You might know Hodgman from his books, or perhaps as the deranged millionaire who appears on The Daily Show.
So, how are we going to balance the budget?
We have to start with cuts to the Pentagon. Do we really need a building with five sides? Honestly, in this economy, isn't that a little extravagant?
You're suggesting we change the Pentagon to, let's say, a rectangle.
A rectangle? What are we, Portugal? No. I'm talking about a rhombus. The most menacing of the quadrilaterals.
But on his podcast, Judge John Hodgman presides over what he calls his court of fake internet law. And in the tradition of all great court shows, he's joined by a bailiff, Jesse Thorne, who also hosts the show Bullseye. The three of us recently convened for a session, and, well, I'll let the judge take it from there.
This is Judge John Hodgman speaking right now, explaining to you, the uninitiated and the lawless, that it is very much like a court show that you would see on TV. People bring disputes before me, the judge, except instead of on television, they call into the podcast. I listen to their various arguments as to who should be doing the dishes or why they should be using hand soap or dish soap or whether a machine gun is or is not a robot. And then I tell them who is right and how they should live their lives.
As I think you can guess from the fact that John just said that one of the cases was whether a machine gun is or is not a robot, while the form is familiar, the content may be a little bit distinctive from your Judge Joe Browns and your Judge Judys.
Yeah, very rarely do we have people who owe money on a car or an apartment. More often, it's someone it's someone who wants to know whether it's okay to instruct the taxi driver to drive through a late-night drive-through after going to a bar.
Well, the domestic sort of disputes are easy to understand, but for machine gun, is it a robot? Who wins that?
The gentleman who is on the side of a machine gun is not a robot. Oh, but you should have heard the argument from the guy who believed a machine gun qualified as a robot. It was very compelling. And that's the thing that made that case worth hearing in the court of fake internet law that is ours. Because these were two friends who had been having this argument for years. The one friend really believed that a machine gun as a machine that served a certain purpose that was devised by a man could qualify under the strictest terms as a robot. But no, obviously the answer is no. A machine gun can kill you, but only if a human is operating it, whereas a robot will just kill you on its own.
The best Judge John Hodgman cases are always about the relationship between the litigants. I remember when I first realized what Judge John Hodgman really was. It was the fifth episode of the show. It was about the custody of this, I'm sorry, robots keep coming up, this toy robot giraffe. And it was these two girls who'd bought this toy robot giraffe when they were in college, and they bought it together, and it had lived with them in their shared house in college, and now one of them had moved away. And they weren't sure who should have custody of this toy because it had so much emotional resonance for them. Mm. And Hodgman's ultimate decision, which I found honestly kind of moving, was that the custody sharing arrangement should essentially require each of them to visit the other on a regular basis. And it respected that what the case was about was not this physical object, but rather its symbolism in this relationship between two best friends.
And I think a lot of the cases that we hear and a lot of the cases that are most productive are young people who are learning to grow up and deal with the responsibilities of sharing a household, sharing a life, and to stop being a sociopathic monster that all all single people in their 20s are.
At the same time, there is this very earnest quality about this that you were just talking about, seeing people through their relationships, that I think people don't often associate that kind of earnestness with.
Well, I have a real sincere fondness for the monsters that come onto the program because because all young people are monsters. And even though they only see me as a faceless mannequin that has no feelings, or they're trying to trick me into letting them get a few minutes of internet podcast fame, you know, these are real issues. You know, the issue of my friend wants to put indoor furniture on his outdoor veranda. We need to teach this young man to not do things like that.
Jesse, your role in this, you're a bailiff. You kind of do everything else. Anything non-judgely, I guess.
Yeah, well, I...
Oh, Jesse can be pretty judgmental, though.
That's what's great about my role on the show. I mean, sort of in a technical sense, I'm the guy who hosts the People's Court who's not Judge Wapner, you know, who interviews the people as they go into the courtroom and so on and so forth. And I'm also sort of Roz from Night Court, which is to say the sassy bailiff. I really have free rein to just periodically berate someone when they do or say something I think is stupid.
So you mentioned that, you know, Jesse, you get kind of judgmental yourself. You tend to be simpatico, but I'm wondering if the two of you have had any serious disputes. Maybe I could help you resolve them.
I don't think that Jesse and I have ever had any direct disputes in our personal lives, if that's what you mean.
Or even, you know, robot versus machine gun sort of disputes.
No, we both know the truth about robots. Come on. We're not fools.
We did disagree on something recently, John. I don't know if you've blocked it out of your mind because you're so wrong on it.
Uh-huh.
But it was the pronunciation of the beloved Vietnamese noodle soup, which I would call something like pho. He said that it should always be pronounced pho.
No, I did not say that.
Couldn't be more wrong.
Arun, may I ask you, is this National Public Radio?
This is.
Nation, this is Judge John Hodgman speaking. All I said was that a consensus was building in the United States of calling it pho because it is most often spelled that way, and that consensus may be wrong, but language is a living thing, and unfortunately usage would go down that road. However, since so many of you have written me back and I've been corrected so heartily, I think we're all going to turn this ship of mispronunciation. And I'm putting myself 100% behind pho, all the way.
Well, John, I accept your apology on behalf of the people of this great nation.
Wow.
See? Things can be worked out.
Not a dry eye in the control room here. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you, Arun.
That was Jesse Thorne and John Hodgman. Their podcast is Judge John Hodgman. For the week ending December 1st, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.